If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Yucky da, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 108. Reason I'm using a Welsh greeting is we're looking at Under Milkwood this time, one of the great radio plays / works by Dylan Thomas, the great Welsh poet. So anyway, how is everybody? Things here are going well. I look out the window, I see a kind of mid-spring sky. The weather's warm. The plants are growing. Everything's going cool there. My fractured wrist, that's an interesting saga. Apparently the bone fragment is not uniting with the other bone, so I'm going to have to get a CT scan and maybe a pin put through my wrist, which is a very kind of Boris Karloff-y thing to have to contemplate. But I'm okay with it. I do live in a country with socialized medicine, so I should be okay. It doesn't hurt much, but I'm kind of aware of it. I've got an awareness of it, and it's got to be fixed. So I'll keep you updated on that. What else has been happening? Had an interesting thing happen on the radio gig. Last week, Ivor and I recorded half an hour of brilliance about Casino Royale. We're leading up to Skyfall coming up. So we recorded that, and then I got a text message Thursday this week saying, we lost the recording. Big drama, big tragedy. The recording didn't get locked. I don't know how they lock it, but somehow on the system they lock it so other people don't delete it. But this one wasn't locked for some reason. It does happen. You know, they're very busy people. And so we did Casino Royale. Excuse me. Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace in half an hour on Friday this week. So that was kind of interesting. Cramming the arc of the new Daniel Craig James Bond film into half an hour of radio took a little bit of work. Apparently it sounded good. Ivor liked it. And I said, yep, because we had a rehearsal last week. But it's the sort of thing that does happen behind the scenes and that people don't ever really hear about much. And I just still do enjoy the weekly radio gig, heading over to South Bank, sitting in the little TARDIS booth and having a chat with my mate Ivor up in Darwin about movies. I mean, there's no downside to that, really. And the other interesting thing about it is, because you're going into the national broadcaster's Melbourne headquarters, A, it's got a lovely little atrium. Occasionally there's people playing music and things in the atrium when I get there. The other thing is famous people come in and out of the TARDIS booth to do interviews. So we've got a few comedians coming in. I've seen federal politicians. I've seen the attack dogs of the conservative parties of Australian politics standing around the lobby looking very unhappy, which is kind of nice. And so it's kind of rubbing shoulders with people that most people only see on television screens, which is really a little bit odd. And the other thing I like about it, and this is a brag, I'll be honest with you, this is a total brag. The security guy at the door knows me by name. So I come in Friday night, so the big beefy security guy that says, "Hi Terry," and I go, "Hi, how's it going?" And then I sign in and I go upstairs in the lovely little glass elevator, very Willy Wonkerish, up to the second floor, take a piss, because you've always got to take a piss before you do radio. That's a tip in case you ever have to do radio, you've got to take a piss. Wait around, do the TARDIS thing, pop back out, go home, and it's a nice way to spend a Friday night. I recommend it if you can get anything like that. It's really, it feels right, it really does, and yes, I am bragging on a little bit about this, and I do a little bit apologise for it, but I do enjoy it very much, and I want to continue doing it. Next week, we're doing Barbarella. We've got another listener request. The last one we got was Last Tango in Paris, you might recall. This time around, we're going to do Barbarella, which is going to be fun. I mean, we're going to have to talk about Jane Fonda naked, which, you know, not bad. And it's a movie that both Ivor and I know very well, so we're going to do that. But the other thing we're going to do is Skyfall comes out in Australia on the 22nd of November, which sucks because it's late. But when it does, we're going to be actually looking at Skyfall as well as the movie we do immediately after I see it, which is kind of cool. I mean, I'm a James Bond geek since the 1960s, literally. One of the first movies I can remember seeing is going to the El Rancho Drive-In in Fairfield, New South Wales, which is now a Catholic ladies' college, and seeing From Russia with Love and Goldfinger back-to-back. I fell asleep halfway through Goldfinger, but it did leave a deep impression on me. A lot of Lenya punching Robert Shaw in the guts, all that sort of thing. So I've been a James Bond geek for a long time. I survived the Roger Moore years successfully. I survived Pierce Brosnan's last effort as James Bond. So this time around, I'm just going to get my full geek on. Apparently Skyfall is very good. It's got Javier Bardem in it. It's got a new Q who looks like a tech nerd, which is always nice. And yeah, I'm just going to be going in there, getting my full 007 happening and really grooving on that. So what have I been watching? Last night, I got a Blu-ray 3-box set with The Searchers, How the West Was Won, and some other Western I've forgotten now. But I watched How the West Was Won on Blu-ray last night. Of course, this was the first of the Cinerama feature films. Before that, Cinerama, the really widescreen format with the three cameras they had in the 1960s before they invented IMAX. This was the first feature film done in Cinerama, and it's got an epic cast. It's got James Stewart in it, Carl Malden's in it, Carol Baker's in it, Debbie Reynolds is in it, a whole bunch of other people, George Peppard, John Wayne, Harry Morgan. So big epic cast. Spencer Tracy does a narration. It's the history of the migration west from the east coast of America. It covers about 40 to 60 years of American history, all in widescreen and all in that really weird Cinerama format. And I enjoyed it. It was interesting, as much from a technical cinema geek way as it was as a cinema piece. When I did a little research on Cinerama, and I found out a couple of interesting things, one of which is you couldn't really do close-ups in Cinerama. The reason is that because of the nature of the cameras and the nature of the way the lenses worked, to do a close-up, you've got to have the camera about 18 inches in front of someone's face, and that kind of inhibits the actor. They're sitting there and they've got this three-lens camera coming up on them like a bloody Dalek. Didn't really work, and they that kind of makes it a slightly weird looking film. Everything's in kind of middle or wide shots, but in spite of that, it's good to see. I picked it up really cheaply in that 3-box set of Blu-ray, so I'm not unhappy about it. But yeah, the second movie, by the way, they did in Cinerama was the Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm. I think George Pal had something to do with that. Had Lawrence Harvey in it, and I think it had the guy from Peeping Tom as well, which made for an interesting duo. But anyway, I watched that and enjoyed it. I think it's worth seeing, particularly if you can get the Blu-ray one, because the depth of field and the quality of the image is really good. They did a restoration on it around 2000, which was well done. But let me see, what else did I watch? I did see The Princess Bride again, because Ivor and I did that on the radio as well. And that got a really good reaction on the radio because everybody who knows The Princess Bride loves it as a movie. And apparently some stoner guy called up to talk to Ivor and to congratulate him on doing The Princess Bride. He quoted, said, "It's a fucking funny movie, mate. Really fucking funny. You should watch it again. It's really fucking funny." So, yeah, so we got a good audience reaction, particularly from the stoner crowd. It's nice to see that the chemically enhanced are listening to my radio gig. Before that, we did Blue Velvet. After doing Last Tango in Paris, I thought I'd challenge myself again and we'd do a little bit of David Lynch. And because of the association with songs like In Dreams and Blue Velvet, I knew Ivor would be interested because he's a very big music buff. And we did that and it worked kind of well. We kind of went the Lynchian route and had a little bit of fun with that. Talked about Dean Stockwell, talked about Dennis Hopper, of course, Isabella Rossellini, Laura Dern, because the two actresses in the film were the children of famous actors. Laura Dern, the daughter of Bruce Dern. Isabella Rossellini, the daughter of Roberto Rossellini, the Italian film director, and Ingrid Bergman. So we kind of played on that a little bit. And again, that was fun. So that's about it from what I've been watching. Nothing else really stands out and grabs me apart from the two movies I'm going to talk about this time, which 9 or 10 minutes into the podcast I should mention. The first one is a 1970 film of Under Milkwood starring Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, Peter O'Toole, and every Welsh actor in London. And from 1957, I thought I'd do a little film, and I heard about this film while I was kind of looking through some stuff on Joseph Losey, who directed it. It's a film called Time Without Pity. It stars Michael Redgrave, Leo McKern, Alec McCowan, and Peter Cushing in the last role he did before he jumped on the Hammer bandwagon and then did the Hammer Frankenstein film. So he's in there playing a lawyer, which is kind of interesting to see him just before he kind of went into that world of Hammer. But yeah, so I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, I think I will look at Under Milkwood first. And then we'll go into Time Without Pity from 1957.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out. You're on this date with me. The pickings have been lush. And yet before this evening is over, you might give me the brush. You might forget your manners, you might refuse to stay. And so the best that I can do is pray. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady tonight. A lady wouldn't flirt with strangers. She'd have a heart, she'd have a soul.
A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me when I bet my life on this road. So let's keep the party polite.
Why don't he shoot?
Why don't he shoot?
Never get out of my sight.
Come on, let's go.
Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with.
Come on,
be a lady.
Guys turning yellow.
Luck be a lady.
What are you scared of?
Luck be a lady tonight.
That, of course, was our famous hoofer and singer Marlon Brando singing Luck Be a Lady from Guys and Dolls. I thought I'd throw that in there just for the fuck of it. Okay, I'm going to read you the start of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood. And I'm probably not going to do it as well as Richard Burton did, but I'm going to give it a go because that's how I roll. To begin at the beginning, it is spring. Moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles. Or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle of by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. So I hope I didn't butcher that too much. Now I'm going to try to play you Richard Burton doing it just to show you how much difference it makes to get a professional actor.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat. There in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now.
See, I reckon it's all those electronic sound effects that make the difference. But anyway, that's the start of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood. Now, Under Milkwood was a stage play, sort of. It was actually a radio drama that Dylan Thomas did in 1954. He'd been working on it for about 10 years. The idea had come to him when he was in a Welsh seaside town. He was walking around the town in the middle of the night and was wondering what the people were dreaming as he was walking through this town. So there were earlier versions of it. There was a thing called Quite Early One Morning. There was a little bit of a poem and that. But Thomas delivered a full draft of Under Milkwood to the BBC in 1953 and then nicked off for a tour of America. He was going to revise a manuscript when he got back, but on the 9th of November 1953, he died in New York. Now, a lot of people think that Dylan Thomas died of the booze. That's not exactly accurate. He didn't die of drinking himself to death in New York pubs, so if you're going to pick a way to go, it's not a particularly bad one. The problem was he had an American agent who had booked him into all these gigs, and the agent's getting 25% off the top. It's a nice earner for this guy, and I forget his name. But anyway, Thomas had bronchitis and pneumonia at the time, and this guy kept booking him into various venues around the place. And basically, he died from the effects of the bronchitis and pneumonia, which, had he been taken to hospital at the correct time, he would not have died of. He may have died in 1960, for instance, of alcohol poisoning, but he wasn't given that opportunity. He actually died of neglect, in a way. And Thomas, well-known Welsh poet, he was known to, when in his cups, stand on tables in pubs and bars and the snugs of hotels, you know, declaiming poetry at the top of his voice, a habit which later on other people took on. At the moment, I'm reading a book. It's called Hellraisers, The Life and Inebriated Times of Richard Burton, Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole and Oliver Reed by Robert Sellers. And these guys basically took on the mantle of Dylan Thomas in their own ways. Of course, Burton knew Thomas. He was the one who knew Thomas. and he did both the BBC version of Under Milkwood. He did the movie in 1970, and his voice was used again and digitally enhanced for a 2012 adaptation as well. So he's pretty much all over that. But these guys were real boozers, and if you get a chance to get the book, and it's been remaded here in Australia, so you should pick it up fairly cheaply in a book barn somewhere. It's quite a good read. Now, while making Under Milkwood, which was a project that he started, Burton talked to the guy who directed the film, who was kind of just a average kind of filmmaker, a guy called Andrew Sinclair, mostly did television work. But he said to Sinclair, "You're lucky that I'm off the booze at the moment." And Sinclair said to him, What do you mean by off the booze?" And he said, "One bottle of vodka a day." So that was basically it. The only other film he made, in fact, the only other film that Andrew Sinclair made was a documentary in 2002 called Dylan on Dylan. So there you go. He was more of a writer himself. In fact, he's had a whole bunch of non-fiction and fictional books, mostly about history, which were the main things he did as an artist. Should have just noticed, I've been saying this movie was done in 1970. It was actually done in 1972, so I do apologise for the error. The cast is very fine. You've got Richard Burton. Elizabeth Taylor has a few small bits. She plays Rosie Probert. Peter O'Toole's in there as Captain Cat, the blind sea captain who dreams of the dead seaman he worked with. You got Glynis Johns playing Mafumi Price, who's in love with Mog Edwards, played by Victor Spinetti, and they exchange letters but never actually consummate the relationship. You got Sharon Phillips, who was Peter O'Toole's wife, playing Mrs. Ogmore Pritchard, who runs a bed and breakfast place, but she's so anally retentive in her cleaning that she'll never accept a guest to the place. She really won't have anyone in there in case they mess things up at all. And she has dreams about her two ex-husbands and bossing them around. You got Angharad Rees, who was in Hands of the Ripper, the Hammer film, playing Gossamer Banan, who people lust after. And you got Glyn Edwards, that people might know from any number of English TV shows, playing Mr. Cherry Owen. And his wife, played by Bridget Turner, they've got a really interesting relationship. Sometimes he's sober, sometimes he's drunk, and he says to her, "You're lucky you've got two husbands, me drunk and me sober." And they're desperately and madly in love, and they're quite life-affirming in that. In fact, most of the characters are incredibly life-affirming. And they've got great character names, like the police constable, who uses his police helmet as a toilet under his bed at night. He's named Attila Rees. You've got Utah Watkins, Bessie Bighead, Dye Bread, Mrs. Rose Cottage, Ockie Milkman, Butcher Evans. Butcher Bainan, Evans of the Death, who's the undertaker. The Reverend Eli Jenkins, Mr. and Mrs. Willy Nilly. Let me see what I got there. Lord Cut Glass. And they're just, it's just the whole idea of the story and the film is that Dylan Thomas was very aware of the possibility of nuclear annihilation. He knew that we could destroy the world. And his way of combating that was to kind of produce a work of affirmation of life. And that's what this is. You've really got to accept the fact that, yes, it's a very unusual film when you see it. It is incredibly unusual, and it's not kind of in any way shaped like a normal film. And Richard Burton, playing First Man, walks through the village almost as a Greek chorus in this one, and a really weird-looking geeky guy called Ryan Davies, the second man, who walks with him. And they walk through the Welsh fishing village called Laragub, which backwards means, spells bugger all, and that was a deliberate choice, of course, by Dylan Thomas's. But it's a beautiful story, and it was filmed in a place called Fishguard down on the Pembrokeshire coast, a little tiny village in a valley on the water. I think I'll play you the trailer. It does repeat the Richard Burton lines at the start of the play, but it does also give you a feel of the weird and wonderful characters that live in Laragub.
Milkwood, and under Milkwood, the village that has captured the imagination of the world. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobbled streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. Only the brilliance of Under Milkwood could attract such an impressive cast of international stars. Richard Burton is the stranger who knows every secret.
From where you are, you can hear their dreams.
Peter O'Toole is Captain Cat, who sees with sightless eyes the lusty pleasures of a well-spent youth and his long-lost loves. Elizabeth Taylor is Rosie Probert, worshipped and adored, irresistible to the captain and his crew. Only the magic of Dylan Thomas could bring to life the bubbling, bursting, vivid vitality of real people the whole world over.
Will you take this woman to be your awful wedded wife?
The warm-hearted humor.
That's where you threw the seagull.
The longing. The loving. The fun. The fear. And the frustration.
Come and get me, Mr. Anybody.
Van Wee Price and her deliriously devoted Mr. Mog Edwards.
She's your ass nicked, yeah? And you a wee killer biscuit. I've throttled your parakeet.
The murderous Mr. Pugh, the infuriating Mrs. Pugh.
Polly Garter. She was martyred again last night.
The much-loved Polly Garter.
We must take our pajamas from the drawer marked pajamas.
And then you must take them off.
Mrs. Ogmore Pritchard, No Good Boyo. Organ Morgan, Butcher Bynum.
Don't care for his common.
Gossamer Bynum.
I want to gobble him all up.
Sinbad Sailors.
I wish that you were not so educated.
And many, many more lovable, laughable, utterly unforgettable characters. Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood.
So what sucks you in with this movie are the characters. You've got Mr. Di Edwards, who's a bigamist, and he lives with Mrs. Di Edwards 1 and Mrs. Di Edwards 2. The first one's a very kind of plain and conservative middle-aged lady, and the second one's a wild gypsy woman. Just it's one of those things that you've kind of got to experience, and you can get the audio recordings. I believe they're on YouTube and a few other places like that, but it's worth finding them. What the play and the movie do, basically, is show you that ordinary people can be interesting, and of course they're all caricatures and all exaggerated examples of various character types that you'll meet in life, but there's a vitality to them and their craziness. There's Mr. Pugh, who constantly tries to poison his wife and for some reason can't just do it, and there are all the women have their dreams and their lusts, and all the men have their dreams and their lusts. And the kind of playboy of the town is a portly middle-aged guy who for some reason is irresistible to women. It's just a lot of fun, and it's very different from a lot of other films. And it is incredibly life-affirming. If you've got the blues at all, watching or listening to Under Milkwood will do it for you. It's just full of an acceptance of the eccentricity of human beings and the fact that they will lust after the unattainable or not be brave enough to attain what they can attain. And there's an incredible acceptance of weirdness in the village of Laragub, which I really like. The fact that they do accept the bigamist and the lustful people and the vicar who never gets anybody into his church, and the weird policeman who shits in his own hat. Of course, one of the things people have done since time immemorial is shitting in the policeman's hat. But this one shits in his own hat. So, Under Milkwood, I really do like it. I don't think it's something I could watch too often. But now and then dipping into it and just kind of letting the poetry of the words wash over you is a lovely thing. There's a beautiful use of the English language in this film and in the stage play, which, of course, Thomas being a poet, comes from that. But it does evoke place and character incredibly well, and it's just a lovely piece of work. I really enjoyed it. Watching it again, I'd seen it once before years ago. You know how sometimes you see movies at a time when your brain's not ready for them? You see them when you're shallow and stupid and looking for tits, and there are a few tits in this film, so you know, watch out for those. But I did see it at a very early age when I didn't know Dylan Thomas and didn't know poetry and didn't know too much about my own Welsh ancestry. But visiting it now, it's the right time for me to see it in a weird way. You know how sometimes that is with films where you see them at just the right time again and you're willing to kind of embrace what they're offering you? That's what I got from this film. This is not going to be on my top list of anything, but I think if you like poetry and you like weirdness, you'd go for it. The weird thing about this film too, of course, is that at the time it was made, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were among the biggest stars in the world. They were bigger than Kardashians. They had an entourage of 30 or 40 people. They couldn't go anywhere without being mobbed by people. This had been going on for 10 years or so since Cleopatra. And the other thing about them too is they were both raging alcoholics. Apparently their friends said the characters they played in movies that most resembled their real life were the ones they played in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The kind of two characters there, they were like that. They were really crazy and over the top and both damaged individuals in a way. Which isn't to say they weren't without virtue, of course. One of the things that Richard Burton did, and I'm a distant relative of his, so I'm a bit jealous of this, is that he looked after his whole extended family. All of the kids went to university. They were supported until they could support themselves. The families were looked after. They were all poor Welsh coal people from the south of Wales, and they were all helped by Burton. Of course, he was also a mean drunk and very much a womanizer. He nailed pretty much all of his co-stars. There's a weird thing. He did Camelot in the early 60s with Julie Andrews. And he was interviewed and said that he slept with all of his leading ladies except Julie Andrews. And she got really insulted by that, which shows where she's coming from. But, reading through Hellraisers, you do get this really weird thing about the four guys, O'Toole, Burton, Harris, and Reed, that the alcohol may have been a part of who they were. Two of them were dyslexic as well. I think Peter O'Toole, Richard Harris and Oliver Reed were dyslexic. And, of course, they had trouble in school, which set them off on a path of being rebels and stopping themselves from being bored. All highly intelligent guys. But the booze really did fuck them around big time. And as someone who doesn't drink much but comes from a family where a lot of people were alcohol impeded, I can kind of sympathise, but I'm kind of distanced from it a little bit as well. But it's a great read. I don't mind reading it all. And there's a lot of really good celebrity gossip in it as well, particularly the stuff to do with the actress Rachel Roberts, who herself was fond of a drop now and then. So, as I said, it's a great read, and you really should get in it. And it gave me a kind of context to the making of Under Milkwood. There's not too much about the film in the book, but there is a lot about where Burton and Taylor's heads were at the time it was made, and which makes for interesting reading. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. I want to get back and go and talk about a small but really interesting little crime drama from 1957 called Time Without Pity, starring Michael Redgrave and Leo McKern.
What's to do? I was alone. So lonely, and then you came out of nowhere like the sun up from the hill. Cold was the wind. trail where your kiss filled me with thrills. A weekend in Canada, a change of scene, was the most I bargained for. Then I discovered you, and in your eyes I found a love that I couldn't ignore. Now, down in the sun, fast beat my heart. Sunset from that day we never part. From that day we never part. From that day.
That, of course, was the Mills Brothers with Canadian Sunset, and that's a shout out to all of the fine Canadian podcasters out there. So on to Time Without Pity, which is a kind of generic title, and I don't really like it as a title for a movie, but the movie itself I do like a lot. It's based on a play by Emily Williams, an English playwright of the middle part of the 20th century, who was quite popular at the time and is kind of forgotten-ish these days. I'll just see if I've got anything else. It was based on a play called Someone Waiting. Of Williams. I haven't been able to find out too much about it, but you can kind of tell that this film was based on a play. For instance, the pre-title sequence tells you who the murderer is, which is kind of unusual in this sort of film. The audience knows who the murderer is right from the word go, and it's not too much of a spoiler to say that, without giving it away entirely, it's the Australian actor in there who's the murderer. But we then cut to Peter Cushing rushing through an airport to pick up Michael Redgrave. Michael Redgrave's character, whose name he said, looking it up again, because it's, again, a generic name, the way that so often these characters are in this kind of a movie. David Graham. Michael Redgrave is not too successful author. He's been in a sanitarium for alcoholism for a fair while, and he's been quite ill. Which is the reason why only a short time before his son's about to be executed for the murder of his girlfriend, he's able to come back to London and try to find out what's happening and try to prove his son innocent. His son's played by Alec McCowan, an actor that you might have seen in things like Travels with My Aunt with Maggie Smith. And if you remember Never Say Never Again, the Sean Connery James Bond film that wasn't really done by Eon Films, he played Q in that. So a jobbing character actor. He always played kind of slightly neurotic characters. He's really good in this. He's quite young in this one, and really solid as well. You can tell that playing against Sir Michael Redgrave really kind of upped his game to in the acting stakes. And the cast in general is quite fine. Anne Todd plays Honor Stanford, the wife of Robert Stanford, Leo McKern's character, who's an industrialist who owns a car manufacturing company. We've got Peter Cushing playing the lawyer. We've got Alec McCowan, of course. Renee Houston, an older Scottish lady. She plays the mother of the character played by Lois Maxwell, who people remember played Moneypenny for a long, long time in the James Bond series. She plays Vicky Harker, the secretary of Leo McKern's character, and she was stunningly beautiful in her younger years, and of course, yeah, quite beautiful in her older years too. But Richard Wordsworth's in this film as well. You might remember Richard Wordsworth from the first Quatermass movie. He's the guy that turned into the monster. You know, the spaceship crashes, they can only find one person out of the three that was up in the spaceship, and he slowly mutates into a monster. That's Richard Wordsworth in there. And also Joan Plowright, who married Olivier years later, is in there as quite a young actress playing a showgirl. Now, Joan Plowright, as we now know her, is a kind of much older lady, slight, you know, plump, very fine actor. But seeing her in a skimpy costume as a young chorus girl is quite an interesting change from the way we're used to seeing her as well. But to get back to the story arc, basically what David Graham does is tries to prove his son innocent with only a couple of days, really, before he's going to be executed. His son won't even give him information. His son's kind of come to terms almost and has numbed himself to the fact that he's going to be executed and won't give out too much information. So this very flawed character, David Graham, he's a recovering alcoholic. He's been very ill for a very long time. He's one drink away from the screaming memes at the best of times. He's been a really shit father. He put his son away into private schools. He wasn't there for anyone in the family. He was very self-absorbed. And really, he's not well either. He's very shaky. In fact, he passes out a few times and goes on a couple of benders as well. As the pressure builds, he can't resist the drink. Passes out and blacks out, basically. And then wakes up with the horrible suspicion that it may be too late. Every time he passes out for whatever reason, he wakes up and asks people what time of day it is, so he knows whether he's totally fucked up and his son's been executed, which incredibly ramps up the tension in this film. It really is a really tight little thriller. He goes and visits everybody. He's not a trained investigator at all. He's actually begging for help from all these people to basically prove his son innocent. And he's very naive. He doesn't put the pieces together very well at all until right at the end when it becomes patently obvious who the killer is. And he knows who the killer is. The killer has confessed to him. And yet he can't get enough evidence at that stage to prove his son innocent. And the clock's ticking way, way down on this. Now, this is a really tight little thriller. It's very melodramatic, of course. The setup and the whole plot is incredibly artificial. But Redgrave sells it really well. He was nominated for a BAFTA award in 1958 for this film. And of course, the thing I most remember him for, but other people may have other memories. Some people may like him in The Importance of Being Earnest. He did the classic version of that as well. But the thing I remember him for is the ventriloquist scene in Dead of Night from, I think, about 1948, where he played a ventriloquist with a very evil ventriloquist dummy. Of course, he is the father of the great acting dynasties, Gemma Redgrave, Vanessa Redgrave, Ling Redgrave, all of those are his descendants as well. And he was quite a flawed character himself, Michael Redgrave. He was bisexual and kind of in the closet, of course. Anybody who was at all in any way gay in 1940s and 1950s England who wasn't in the closet was probably in jail, because they did arrest people for that. I really should do the Dirk Bogarde movie Victim at some stage for the podcast, because that kind of links into a lot of other themes that I've dealt with when talking about English cinema of a certain time in the podcast. But I really do like Redgrave in this. He's just hanging on to everything by his fingernails throughout the film, and he plays it really well. I mean, he doesn't overplay it. He doesn't really give it more than it requires to put this stuff across, and he's really a weak but sympathetic character, and that's a hard one to play. Weak characters we don't tend to have a lot of time for in film, but because he's on this mission to save his son's life, even though his son doesn't want a bar of him and very rightly tells him at various times where to go, he's on this kind of mad crusade almost, a redemption thing to save his son, and he finds a very unusual way to do it. I'm not going to do a spoiler on the ending, because the ending's worth keeping and treasuring, but there is a really nice tight ending to this film which ties up the loose ends really neatly in a very short period of time. Now, the other person really to take note of on this is the Australian actor Leo McKern. See how I slid that in? Leo McKern's like a national treasure here in Australia. People know him from the TV series The Prisoner. He was very fine in that, playing number two a couple of times. Ron Polo, the Bailey, of course, all those things when he was an older actor. But taking a look at the smaller roles that Liam McKern did in the late 50s and early 60s, in things like The Day the Earth Caught Fire, I've done that on Paleo Cinema Podcast before, he really is undervalued as an actor. And his character in this film is really choice. He's got a northern accent. Liam McKern lost one eye at the age of 15 in an accident. And that kind of stare that he's got where one of the eyes isn't quite tracking, he uses to full effect in Time Without Pity. Really, he's not tall, he's portly, he's got funny-looking hair, he's not a pretty man at all. But his character, Robert Stanford, is a force of nature in this film. He knows what's what. He's insecure and blustering and bullying. He's a really weird combination of strong and weak, and a really great piece of acting in this one. I'm surprised that Redgrave, of course, being theatrical, probably got the BAFTA nod for this because of the role he did. But I reckon Leo McKern's at least as good playing Stanford. He really is mesmerizing on the screen when you see him in this film. And then, of course, we've got Joseph Losey, the director. This is the first film Losey made for a number of years under his own name because he was blacklisted by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And from 1951 till this film came out in 1957, he did a few other films of no real note under pseudonyms just because he couldn't get a gig under his own name. And then with this one, fairly low budget, not an A film by any means, but geez, it's solid. It really is a powerful piece of cinema, this one. And not in a drawing attention to itself sort of way. It's a good, honest little crime movie. And the more I see overblown blockbusters, which some of which I like. I mean, I'm very fond of blockbusters in various ways. But now and then, after you've seen a whole bunch of really big CGI films with stars, and some actors are great, and some of them should be serving chips across a counter, to see a small, tight, well-written, incredibly well-acted film like Time Without Pity, it kind of refreshes you. It's a nice change of gear from modern film, and I really do like the fact that this is the first time I've seen this film. I heard about it. I knew Liam McKern was in it. I heard that Redgrave was good in it, so I acquired a copy, and acquired, of course, is in quotation marks. And it's good. Really do like it. It's on my list of films, small films that nobody knows about that you really should see. And I'll just try to play some of the audio. There's not too much I could get that was good from this film, but I'll play a couple of bits of audio just to give you a bit of a feel. The first one, and I apologise for the sound quality on this, is Redgrave with Alec McCowan in the prison when he's interviewing him and they're talking about their past relationship. And the second bit's a little bit between Ann Todd playing Stanford's wife and Liam McKern playing Stanford, and you just get the idea of this guy.
One of your longer drunks. You were in the sanatorium. The prosecution brought it up. They thought it would be good for their case, I suppose. A drunken father, bad blood.
I came as soon as I could, Alec.
You're drunk now.
Oh, no. I haven't had a drink for a long time. It was just that I couldn't get here sooner. I've been very sick.
Even before this happened, you hadn't written for months.
I know. I'm sorry. But forgive me. But it didn't matter. Somehow, we always knew that we were together, you and I. Do you remember?
I remember every letter you did write. Every word. The most frightening boarding schools you put me in. And the weeks, months that would go by without seeing you. And then you'd show up with a silly little gift of atonement in your pocket.
Robert Stanford. The mighty Robert Stamford. You're like a sick schoolboy peering through half-open windows.
Don't you say that to me. Anna? Anna!
Keep away from me.
No, Anna, don't leave me alone.
Keep away.
Anna!
All of them's finished with Time Without Pity, but there is one bit that I found really interesting and kind of a little bit bold in the way that Joseph Losey handled it. When he's talking to Mrs. Harker, the drunken old lady played by Renee Houston, there are two things in the scenes that really do ramp the tension. First off, she's drunk and the Michael Redgrave character is a drunk. So she's trying to play with alcohol and he's trying to resist. And that's one sense of the tension between them. The other tension is she's a drunk, but she also has an obsession with clocks, and her room is full of clocks, and the alarms keep going off at random intervals, and she likes that. She finds it reassuring. But to him, it's a constant reminder that the clocks are ticking down on his son's execution. So not only do you have the temptation of the alcohol, but you have the reminder that time is passing for this guy, and he's trying to get information about who the actual murderer is from this insane, alcoholic, middle-aged lady. So it ramps up the tension enormously, and it's played very well by both actors. And having that audacity to do the kind of room full of clocks as a metaphor for the fact that time's winding down for him to save his son is a kind of a bold move, but it's the sort of thing that you can kind of forgive in a film like this. And of course it would have been in the stage play, I assume. I haven't seen the stage play, of course, but it's just one of those things that you kind of go, wow, that was a really gutsy move to make. And that's what this film is. It's a small, inexpensively made 1950s British thriller. And there are so many of those to discover. We're only just kind of finding out about a lot of them because they didn't get a lot of press, and they're not incredibly well known, but there are a number of them, and they're all ballsy as hell. So I'm going to take another break now. When I come back, I'll do some feedback.
Stasem vaka, punta do kamie zastavia. Non mangia chiù, non dorme chiù, cape condria. Quei piccini che viene a dista gelosia. Tu va su qui, tu va a morire, chi to fa fa. Corre in braccio tua mamma,
corre in braccio tua mamma.
Non facciamo piccini,
non facciamo piccini.
Dille tutta verità,
dille tutta verità.
Che mamma ve può capire. E passa e spazza sotto sto balcone, ma tu sei guaglione. Tu non conosci femmine. Sei ancora così giovane, tu sei guaglione che di mise in capo va a giocare a pallone, che vanno di ste lacrime, vatti non mi fa ridere, corre in braccio tua mamma,
corre in braccio tua mamma,
non facevo piccini,
non facevo piccini,
dille tutta verità,
dille tutta verità,
che mamma ve può capire. Non alliscia sti mustacelle, non cerca te, non so per te chi so che bella. Non a pensa, va pazzia quei guaglioncelle. Non t'avvili, c'è tempo in per te inguaia. Chi desidera va sa,
chi desidera va sa,
scuda della piccini,
scuda della piccini.
Casi dice na papà,
casi dice na papà,
chissà come va a finire. E passa e spassa sotto sto balcone, ma tu sei guaglione. Tu non conosci femmine, sei ancora così giovane. Tu sei guaglione che ti mise in capo, va a giocare a pallone. Che vanno di ste lacrime, va a te non mi fa ridere. Corre in braccio tua mamma,
corre in braccio tua mamma.
non facemo picciri,
non facemo picciri,
dille tutta verità,
dille tutta verità,
che mamma ve può capì, sta sempre qua, puntato qua mi è già sta via, non mangia più, non dorme più, chi to fa fa.
That was yet another version of Guaglione by the Botte Endor Quartet. That song has a number of different names. It was a pop tune in the 50s and 60s called Bambino, which you may remember from the Jean Dujardin movie OSS 117, Code Nest of Spies. But yeah, I just thought I'd pop it in there because it's kind of got that small jazz band weirdo feel about it. It's one of those tracks you play to fuck with people's minds, and I hope it did. Now let's get on with the feedback. I wonder who this could be.
Hey, Paleo Cinemas, Dog Zom. You would think that I would get enough, or I would have had enough of talking to Terry Frost on the last episode of Paleo Cinema with our ginormous conversation about Burt Lancaster and watching R-rated movies and copying adult films and lots of other topics of discussion. Just took a long walk on the trail and got introduced to a new movie by Paleo Cinema called Private Hell 36. I'd never heard of this movie. I will be checking it out. I remember Howard Duff, but I think I remember him mostly from like some old TV shows, or well, when he got older. But I do remember seeing him in some other movies and, you know, liking his stuff. Got some background on some Steve Cochran sexual exploits, as well as Ida Lupino. She had some sexual exploits, too. But anyway, yeah, it was a good show. I liked listening to that. You got me through about 8 miles of walking and getting drugged through the brush by the moots, eh? So I just wanted to say, until next time, I will be listening, I will be walking, and I will be burning lots of lard off my bulbous belly. Yeah.
Thanks, Zom. Hope your dog's not messing up your bed as much as it was, because I just saw your Facebook. Yeah, the Private Hell 36 and Ida Lupino. Ida Lupino was hot. I don't care what anyone says. As a young actress, she was muy caliente. So I got to say that for her. But then, as Sal has often pointed out, I like weird-looking chicks, so who knows? I did also hear from Morris. We communicated via work. Morris from over at Love That Album podcast. He enjoyed the last episode of Paleo Cinema as well. And he has been and hopefully will continue to be a great supporter of it. There wasn't too much else feedback. The Martian Driving podcast is getting the bulk of the feedback at the moment, which is okay. I'll live with it. I promise not to cry about it. But the other thing I should remind people too is if you go to paleo-cinema.com, you can record your feedback via a little widget on the right-hand side of the page. You can do the same with the Martian Driving podcast too. Click on that, record it with whatever audio thing you have, and you can pass the feedback through that way. The audio quality comes through nicely. I get a nice little report when somebody else rings the bell. And always a little bit of fun. So I'm going to leave it there. This is going to be a fairly short Paleo Cinema. I do apologize for that. Things have been running around madly here. But anyway, I'm going to do a shout out to all the usual suspects. Love That Album podcast, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, B-Movie Cast. Thanks a lot, Vince. I know you've given me some feedback for the next Martian Drive-In. I do appreciate that, mate. Let me say, I do hope also that the storms didn't hit you too badly either. I know that you are in the electricity generation industry, and Hurricane Sandy may have affected you. What kind of name is that for a hurricane? It makes it sound like a Neptune chiller rather than a force of nature. But anyway, also, of course, Hammockers Podcast, 51 Down Place. Mail Order Zombie, of course. Let me just go into my little save thing for all of the other ones, because I don't want to miss anybody out. Let me have a look. What I was thinking of doing for next time, while I'm looking that up, what I was thinking of doing is doing a couple of more Rod Taylor movies, because there's been big talk over at the GGTMC about Dark of the Sun and how fucking awesomely macho and cool that movie is. And to be honest with you, I can't disagree. I like it a lot. Vince over at the B-MovieCast gave me a copy of Dark of the Sun, and you know, Greater Love Hath No Man. Okay, the other podcasts that I really like, as I said, Hammer, blah, 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 all those ones. Silver and Gold podcast, of course. Shooting the Pooh podcast, The Writer and the Critic. Galactic Suburbia from the Feminist Cabal. Just all of you guys, you know who you are, and send me little promos. I'm in the mood for some more promos too, if people want to swing them my way. I'll be chucking some more into the next podcast as well. But as I said, that's about it this time around. Feeling a little bit tired because I did 6 kilometers on the bike after a break. The break being the one of my wrist. And I'm feeling a little bit knackered at the moment. I may just kind of sit back and relax after recording, uploading and editing and all that kind of thing. This, I'll tell you what I'm going to watch as my chill out movie. That's probably something I could do. Let me just go into my movies and TVs folder. Cha cha cha. Is anybody else looking forward to Skyfall too? I'm just hanging out for that. I said on the radio this week that Skyfall, every time a new James Bond movie comes out, that's my Olympics. I don't give a shit about sport, but when a new James Bond movie comes out, I've got to see it. So hanging out for that. Let me have a look here. And I did that entirely wrong, which is always a bit wonderful. Probably the movie that I'm going to do as my post-podcast wind-down piece of cinema. I was thinking of doing Secret of the Incas with Charlton Heston and Yima Sumac. Something along those lines. The other possibilities are, he said, looking through the list of stuff I haven't watched yet. There's a movie from 1952, a musical called Skirts Ahoy. I think it's got Louis Jordan in it doing a novelty act, so I thought I might watch that. Or else Swing Parade from 1946. I'm in the mood for a couple of musicals that I haven't seen before, and I haven't seen either one of those. They're kind of jive swing era musicals, and I just thought I'd kind of go with those and see how I went with them. But next time around, I'll trying to find 2 Rod Taylor movies. I've got a couple in mind that I might throw out there for the next Paleo Cinema in 4 weeks' time. It will be, he said, thinking it through, probably the Newton Mass episode. So I'm going to probably play lots of Yuletide-friendly music and that kind of stuff. We're getting towards that time of the year, and with the podcasts individually coming out every 4 weeks, but I'm alternating between the two. It's creeping up on me very, very fast, so we'll have the Newton Mass episode for the month of December with a couple of Rod Taylor movies. The other thing I should mention is that I mentioned this over on the GGTMC Facebook page. Mark Hartley, the guy who did Not Quite Hollywood and Machete Maidens Unleashed, is doing a documentary about Rod Taylor. He's gone over to the States to interview Rod. And that one should be a kick-ass one. I am definitely picking that one up on disc, because the two previous docos, Not Quite Hollywood and Machete Maidens Unleashed, really did kick-ass. They treat the subjects respectfully. They've got innovative ways of telling the story visually, and they just rock. So anyway, having said that, I am going to go away and watch a couple of obscure 1940s musicals. Take care of yourselves. Stay safe. If you're in a part of the world where you get to vote for either Barack Obama, that guy looks deceptively like Bob from The Church of the Subgenius, but isn't, I hope you make the right decisions. For me, I'm kind of like Obama. I think it's much cooler. I would rather hang out in a cocktail bar or a cafe with a Barack Obama than I would with Mitt Romney, for the simple fact that Obama would probably have a beer or at least a coffee, and Mitt and Romney would have neither of those. Really take care of yourselves, particularly if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. The weather is getting frightful there, and you can't just sit back and say, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow, when the water is creeping over the top lip of your lip. And if you're in New York and you listen to this, and there are a few listeners in New York, take care of yourselves, guys. I did see everything that happened over there, and ain't nice. And if you see a climate change denier when you're sloshing your way through the mud and muck of New York City, do me a favor, hit them over the head, throw them down a flooded subway tunnel, and you'll make the world a better place. Catch you later.